All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for joining us. We have the Southwest Florida Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. The event we're having today is the First Amendment, Social Media, and Section 230. We have with us here today Professor Eugene Volek. Professor Volek is the Gary T. Swartz Distinguished Professor at Law at UCLA School of Law, where he teaches First Amendment law and, among other things, has a First Amendment amicus brief clinic. Just Professor Volek clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor at the U.S. Supreme Court and Judge Alex Kaczynski on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Professor Volek is a member of the American Law Institute. And finally, he is the founder and co-author of the leading legal blog, The Volek Conspiracy, which my wife is a big fan of. And also Professor Volek is a double UCLA Bruin in addition to his teaching there. So good luck tonight with the basketball game against Michigan State. We also
it
have-
means nothing to me. I don't care about sports. In fact, I'm against it, at least college sports.
Fair enough. We also have with us Baron Soka. Mr. Soka is the president of Tech Freedom. Prior to that, he was the senior fellow and director of the Center of Internet Freedom at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. Mr. Soka received his Juris Doctorate from the University of Virginia. After that, he clerked for the Honorable H. Dale Cook, a senior judge at the United States District Court for the Northern District of Oklahoma. In practice, Mr. Soka worked at Latham & Watkins and another boutique firm in Washington, D.C., where he focused on internet and telecommunications. So thank you all both for joining us here today. We're really grateful that you would take the time out to talk with us. Like I said, our discussion here today is free speech, First Amendment, and social media. And I think the biggest, I guess, first point we have is one more important than the other? Is it the First Amendment or the Section 230 that we need to focus on when we're having this debate regarding social media? Baron, is that
well,
something?
I'll take that to start, and I'll just mention two things that you didn't mention in my bio. One, I'm starting the Eugene Volek fan club because I've been a great fan of Eugene's work for over a decade. There is no law professor in America I respect more. And Eugene knows a lot more about the First Amendment than anyone, including me. And as you'll hear today, I think most of our disagreement is about how the facts apply rather than the law. But it's just an honor to be discussing this with Eugene and to get to do what I tried to do. Second thing I would add to my bio, I ran the speakers program at the UVA Federalist Society. And I always tried to do what the Book of Isaiah calls us to do, which is come, let us reason together. And I'm really excited to be doing that today. I think that's exactly the kind of conversation we'll be having instead of the usual conversation, which involves people misrepresenting both Section 230 and the First Amendment. That's not what you're going to hear today. You're going to hear a lot of discussion of some hard questions about the law and how the nature of social media will be determinative in how the law applies here. So, to answer your question about Section 230, I would just start by saying that this debate is very confusing to many people because Section 230 does two very different things. And mostly people think about Section 230 as ensuring that websites are not held liable for content that they host or provide access to, like search engines, for example. And that's the debate about sex trafficking and opioids and so on. And in that respect, Section 230 changed the common law. That was the whole point of the law. There had been two prior court decisions that said that websites would become more liable if they tried to moderate content, or an earlier decision that said that websites might be held liable as distributors if they knew or had reason to know of unlawful content. And in that respect, Congress superseded the common law and said, no, that creates a perverse incentive not to moderate. And it would make the development of interactive computer services very difficult, if not impossible. So Congress changed the common law. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Section 230 protects websites from being sued for decisions they make to moderate content, to withdraw it, to hide it, to take it down, whatever that might be, to ban users. And in that respect, Section 230, in my view, doesn't change the law. It simply extends what would have been the application of the First Amendment anyway, but it provides essentially a civil procedure change. It says that you don't have to litigate those difficult and extremely expensive to litigate First Amendment questions, and you can instead simply file a motion to dismiss under Section 230 and get the lawsuit dismissed. And that of course, is a huge change. It's essentially kind of tort reform. It says that you don't have to do this asymmetrical warfare where it's very, very cheap to file a complaint, but it costs a lot of money to defend against a case. And now this is the functional dichotomy in how 230 operates. And most people, including some very smart lawyers, assume when they understand that, they assume that the statute neatly maps onto that distinction. And they read the statute and they say Section C1 talks about not being treated as a publisher. And Section C2A says you can remove content. So therefore, the functional dichotomy maps onto that distinction between those two sections. And that's not the way the statute was written or intended or has been interpreted by the courts, because Section 230 C1 says you're not to be held liable or treated as a publisher of information provided by another or as the speaker. And the courts, starting in 1997 and consistently since then, in every decision involving these cases, have held that what it means to be treated as a publisher is both to put up content, to host it, and also to withdraw it. In other words, content moderation is covered by both of the key immunities in Section 230, C1 and C2A. And the difference between them is when they apply. C1 only applies if you're not responsible for creating content that someone else has posted, whereas C2A is a backstop provision that applies even if you did help to create it, even if you edited it and became responsible in part for creating it and then decided to take it down. So that's the backdrop against which we're having this conversation. And I say all this to say that is the legal source of a great deal of legal confusion. But if you understand all of that, I think you reach my conclusion, which is that even if you repealed Section 230 today, the dynamics of litigation would change radically. Yes, websites would be very hesitant to moderate content. But ultimately, if they were willing to go through the expense of litigation, the substantive outcome on content moderation wouldn't change because the application of the First Amendment would be the same. And so that's why, to answer your question today, I think it's constructive for us to talk about what the First Amendment would mean here and whether a state or the federal government could pass laws that seek to compel websites to host content they don't want to host, even in the absence of Section 230. And my answer in a nutshell is no.
And Professor Bublik, do you feel the same way?
Yeah, so I agree largely, or in fact, probably almost entirely with what Barron had said so far. And by the way, let's do it on a first name basis. Barron and I think, call each other Barron and Eugene, so please feel welcome to do the same. So here are the two relevant provisions. Do you folks see the Section C1 and C2 on the screen?
No, I do.
Didn't share? Okay, so C1 says no provider or user shall be treated as a publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So that's why if somebody sues Twitter because I supposedly have a libelous material that I posted via Twitter on the Twitter servers, they can say, hey, we're immune from liability because you're trying to treat us as a publisher or speaker of Volex information if you're trying to sue us for libel. Section C2 says no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be held liable on account of any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be offensive in various ways or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. So here's an example. Let's say somebody says, well, Twitter, you blocked this account, and we think you blocked it because of its religious message. We think we blocked it because it was, let's say, a pro Falun Gong message, let's say, or pro Sikh message or something like that. And we think that under state public accommodations law, like maybe California's Unruh Civil Rights Act, that violates your duty to treat your users equally without regard to religion. At that point, Twitter isn't being treated by the law as the publisher or speaker of information. In fact, the whole premise for liability under this public accommodation statute would be that it's not a publisher or speaker, but that it's a place of public accommodation, that it's a host, that it's a platform. But it would have immunity under 230C2 because it says, look, we restricted it because we thought it was offensive for various reasons. We consider it to be otherwise objectionable. That's very strong protection for us, a very broad protection. And therefore, we're entitled to immunity from this state public accommodation statute. Now, note, these state public accommodation statutes may not even apply in this situation under state law. And if they do, they'd apply to only a very limited range of editing decisions, chiefly ones based on religion, maybe your sexual orientation. In a few states, maybe political affiliation, but only a few jurisdictions, mostly cities. So the thing about 230C2 is it hardly ever actually makes a huge difference because there's no cause of action, state law cause of action, usually to be trumped by 230C2 because usually platforms are entitled to eject whatever speakers they want because under state law, it's their property. They're entitled to do that. But even if state law purports to restrict these platforms' powers, Section 230 would preempt that state law. Now, maybe later on, we'll get to some creative and maybe successful, although let's say long shot arguments as to why 230C2 might itself be preempted by the First Amendment. But 230C2 is, generally speaking, does provide very broad preemption of state attempts to require equal access, let's say, or to platforms or to treat platforms as common carriers. So that's why, generally speaking, if there's going to be a move to really restrict platforms in an effective way, that is to say, restrict them in the sense of restrict their ability to kick someone off based on their speech or based on their viewpoint, they would probably have to be done at the federal level. There are some state laws being proposed. And again, there are some arguments as to how they can evade 230C2. But as a general matter, Section 230 does indeed entitle platforms to pick and choose what material to host and what not to host.
So with that, I think then we really need to turn our discussion to the First Amendment. And at this point, for all of our attendees out there, this is going to be an interactive conversation. So there is the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. Feel free to pose questions to our panelists as we engage in this discussion. And they will answer them as they're we're going through our discussion here today. So Baron, like you said, it seems then, and like Eugene said, we need to focus on the First Amendment. And as we were talking today and hearing what you said in your opening, it seems like you're focused on the government should not be able to or cannot impose restrictions because these social media companies are private entities, right?
Not only are they private entities, but they are private entities that produce an expressive product. So they're not like a shopping mall or some other store. They are, or they're not even like cable providers or the telephone company. They are in the business of providing a community that is curated, and that's exactly how they hold themselves out to their users. So I'm a telecom lawyer by training. I do a mix of telecom and speech law. And the difference to me is very stark. So we've spent much of the last 15 years debating net neutrality. But the fundamental point about net neutrality and the reason ultimately that the 2015 order was upheld in court, is that the FCC's rules that required no blocking or throttling, those rules only ever applied to services that held themselves out as providing connectivity to the entire internet, that held themselves out as not blocking or throttling. And in that sense, that kind of common carriage regulation and in the common law is a kind of consumer protection. It ensures that consumers are getting what they are promised. And ultimately, what the DC Circuit said when this was challenged, and Judge Kavanaugh then made a First Amendment argument saying that the rules violated the First Amendment rights of the broadband providers. The judges who had written the panel decision in explaining why the DC Circuit en banc refused to rehear the case said, look, companies can, broadband companies can opt out of these rules. They could make a different disclosure. They could change the nature of their offerings and make clear up front that they would block or throttle, that they wouldn't provide connectivity to the entire internet. And if you understand that that's the baseline, that it takes very little to opt out of that status, you then have to ask, how different is Twitter, say, from Comcast? And the answer is fundamentally, because Comcast says we will provide you connectivity to the entire internet. Twitter and Facebook and every other one of these services says we create a community. It's very important to us that we don't allow hate speech and misinformation and fake accounts and so on. And it's inherently subjective as to how we apply those terms of service. And the entire debate we're having is about that exercise of editorial discretion and what is being proposed at the state level and Congress in one way or another is an attempt to supersede the editorial control of a private media company over a production that that has a collective expressive content for which they are held liable. And this is when I said at the outset that a lot of what Eugene and I disagree about is about facts. This is what I mean. So he'll point to cases where the court has noted that that children understand that schools might be compelled to say certain things and that children don't hold schools responsible for that. That may be true. That may be true of law schools when they're doing recruiting, that law students understand that the government is compelling the military to be allowed to recruit on campus. But it's very clear that every social media site is held responsible by market forces for the overall content of their service. And we have to look no further for that than what they say to their investors. I mean, they start their investor calls, just for example, in the fall, when Facebook put out its fourth quarter earnings report. It started its investor calls, third quarter, right before the election, talking about their efforts to deal with misinformation and abuse of their service, because they said they are held responsible for that. And their SEC filings say our reputation can suffer because of these things. And we try very hard to manage content on these services. So that's, in a nutshell, that's them saying market forces judge us by the content that is on our service and how we moderate it. And my position, in a nutshell, is that the government can no more intrude upon that than it can intrude upon the rights of a newspaper to make the same sort of editorial decisions, or a parade organizer to decide what kind of signs can be carried in its parade.
I wanted to again put up a little slide so that we can quickly go through some of the key cases, because this is really, this is indeed a matter of maybe the facts, but maybe kind of how you characterize the facts. Which box do you fit? The facts into? Let me share this slide here. Let's look at how hosting obligations are treated by the law. So there's a case, Miami Herald v. Ternillo, a very famous case, which says a newspaper can't be required to publish replies to criticism of candidates. That's an important free speech protection. So even if a state law does say this, and of course most states don't require that even in the first place, but if it does say that, that violates the newspaper's First Amendment rights. Because in part, newspaper is all about what it excludes as well as what it includes. We often read a newspaper beginning to end, and you trust its editorial judgment to present to you the material that it thinks is worthwhile, even when it's passing along material from third parties. Likewise, in Hurley, the parade case, the court held that parade organizer can't be required to include floats and dislikes, again, in part because a parade is viewed as sort of a coherent whole. People often go and watch a whole parade beginning to end, or at least a chunk of it. On the other hand, in the Pruneyard case, the court said a shopping mall may be required to allow leafletters and signature gatherers. Now, I would imagine that a late 1970s California, before the California Supreme Court announced that requirement that it imposed on shopping malls, many people might have held shopping malls account responsible for allowing leafletters that they disapprove of. They might have complained to the shopping malls because people generally expect that private property owners are responsible for what is done on their property. But notwithstanding that, the Supreme Court said that the California law could, if it wanted to, impose this requirement of equal public access on large shopping malls. And that if the shopping malls wanted to respond to people's, or not even respond, but if shopping malls were concerned that people might think that leafletters and signature gatherers are endorsed there, they could simply put up a disclaimer. Turner Broadcasting, the court likewise held that a cable system may be required to carry broadcast channels. The cable system didn't want to, wanted to carry the channels that it had, that it preferred. But no, the Congress said you must also carry the broadcast channels as well. And the Supreme Court said that that's constitutionally permissible. And then in Rumsfeld v. Fair, the court said a private university may be required to allow military recruiters. Now, Rumsfeld involved a funding program, but the way the court upheld it is it said, look, even if this were a total mandate, not just a funding condition, but a categorical mandate, university can be required to allow military recruiters. Now, universities actually did have pretty serious objections to the presence of the military recruiters, not so much, I think, because the universities were pacifists, but because they were against the military's don't ask, don't tell policy, which discriminated based on sexual orientation. And I'm sure many university students demanded that the universities exclude these military recruiters. Nonetheless, the court said it's permissible for the government to require universities to allow such recruiters. Now, what's the difference between the first two cases and the last three cases? Well, here's a line that I think captures things well from Hurley. And I do think that Barron is right. It shows that when we're talking about platforms, we're in a somewhat new scenario. We need to figure out where to place the platforms in these precedents. And you could argue that they are more like one or more like the other. So in Hurley, when the court was explaining why a parade can't be required to include floats, but a cable system can be required to include channels, court said the programming offered on various channels by a cable network. By network, they meant a cable system, not like a network like ABC or ESPN. Consists of individual unrelated segments that happen to be transmitted together for individual selection by members of the audience. So the theory is the parade is this coherent whole. People watch the parade, and if you require the parade to include floats that the parade organizers don't approve of, it's now a different parade. On the other hand, a cable system, you know, there's channel 2, channel 3, up to channel 99, let's say. And people tune into channel 2 to see what that channel wants to show you, then channel 50 to see what that channel wants to show you, and the like. I'm inclined to say that when it comes to basically the hosting that the hosting of a particular account, let's say, a particular user's feed, Twitter is more like the cable company. Twitter, just to take an example. An even clearer example would be WordPress, like a blog hosting software. That would be very much like hosting company. Twitter is a little bit mixed. So let me share just the page with my Twitter feed. So there you have it. Vala Conspiracy on the left. This is all my stuff. This is people tune into it. If they go to twitter.com/Wildlexi, or if they subscribe to the feed on the app, they're looking not for Twitter's message. They're looking for my message. On the other hand, look at the right-hand side. What's happening? Well, that is Twitter. Now, it's not Twitter itself writing all those headlines, but it's Twitter selecting what it wants to promote to people. So I think that as to the right-hand column, Twitter does have First Amendment rights to decide what to include and what not to include. Just like Pruneyard, the shopping mall, had every right to put up signs of its own or not put up signs of its own in places where it was speaking. So it could put up a big Merry Christmas sign and decide not to put up a Happy Hanukkah sign. I think that would be its First Amendment rights. But when it came to people going onto the property and expressing their own views, even using the shopping mall's property, then it could be compelled to host it because it wasn't being compelled to speech. Likewise with Rumsfeld v. Fair, although with Rumsfeld v. Fair, if anything, university, that kind of the right-hand column is even bigger. The university uses the university property overwhelmingly for its own speech and for the speech of people that it selects. It is entitled to decide which classes to teach, which classes not to teach. It's entitled to decide which messages to express as the university's messages. It's entitled to decide whom to invite for university-sponsored lecture series. As to that, it has free speech rights, which the court in Rumsfeld acknowledged, and it has rights to be free from compelled speech. So if the university says, we will refuse to invite anybody from the military to give a graduation speech or even give a guest speech in one of our lecture series because we disapprove of the military's policy, it would have every right not to do that. But when it came to deciding who can speak in the classrooms or interview rooms during recruiting season, that was seen as the speech of the recruiters, and therefore the university could be required to host it. Likewise, I think this left-hand column, or maybe the middle column, that's my speech. Now, under current law, it's my speech on Twitter's property, and Twitter has every right to kick me off. But if Congress wanted to say that that column is essentially, you are a common carrier. You are like the cable system in Turner. You are like the university in Rumsfeld v. Fair being required there not to allow all speech, but allow the government speech. So I'm inclined to say that in that respect, this middle column is really a lot more like the property of the cable system, the property of the shopping mall, the property of the university, where this really is individual segments that happen to be transmitted together for individual selection by audience members. Now, of course, one difference is they're not quite as unrelated, right? Twitter makes it easier for people to forward things, for comments to appear and such. So that does raise interesting questions at what point certain kinds of relationships are enough to make it Twitter's coherent speech product. But I think as to that middle column, and the same thing with regard to Facebook pages, the same thing with regard to blogs hosted at WordPress, the same thing with regard to videos on YouTube, that is more like Turner rather than like Hook.
Well, this is the essence of our disagreement. As I say, it is largely a disagreement about facts. So let's just rewind to Rumsfeld. So I think Eugene did a really nice job of summarizing the different things that a university can and can't be compelled to do. Well, the most important thing to know about Rumsfeld is that the court clearly held that the thing at issue there, recruiting, was not speech. That the regulation was a regulation that was primarily of conduct. And the court said that any regulation of the university's speech was, quote, plainly incidental to the Solemn Amendment, which is what required the school to do that. To the extent that the university had to speak at all, what it was being asked to do was to state when the recruiting happened, what room to go to, how to sign up for it. In other words, the compelled speech there involved statements of fact entirely. And most importantly, the court said that this potential for confusion that we've been talking about didn't exist there, because they said that not only what I mentioned earlier, that students understand that schools can be compelled to do certain things, but also they said that a law school's recruiting services lack the expressive quality of a parade, a newsletter, or the editorial page of a newspaper. So the question is that true? Is any of that true here? And my position, again, is that that what Twitter and Facebook do is essentially no different from a newspaper. It is functionally different. It works differently. But of course, we understand that, and Eugene's written about this better than anybody, that the First Amendment applies regardless of distinctions, that it's not a protection for the institutional press, as he's written. It's a functional protection, and it really protects the exercise of editorial judgment. So what did the court say in Rumsfeld about Pruneyard? It said, we explained that there was little likelihood that the views of those engaging in the expressive activities would be identified with the owner of the shopping mall, who remained free to disassociate himself from those views, and who was not being compelled to affirm a belief in any governmentally prescribed position or view. Okay, so a shopping mall isn't in the speech business. It's incidental whether speech appears on its property. And yes, it may have been true in that time that some customers would have complained about it. But the shopping mall wasn't, for example, telling its investors on its quarterly calls or the Securities and Exchange Commission that that its brand value, its income stream, depended on its reputation, and its reputation depended on how it moderated speech. That's what social media sites do, and they do that because they are in essentially the same business as newspapers. Both business models involve relying on advertisers to be willing to put a commercial speech about their products next to the non-commercial speech that is the mainstay of that platform, whether it's the newspaper or social media site. And what we're really talking about here is whether a social media site is going to be compelled against its will to carry speech, not just that it finds repugnant, but that its users find repugnant, users who may leave the site and go to another site because of the way that that site handles speech, or may decide not to use social media in general, but also advertisers. We are now seeing investors bring shareholder suits against companies like Home Depot and major advertising companies, companies that handle $36 billion of advertising for leading brands. Their investors are trying to get them to stop putting money into sites that don't do enough to moderate hate speech or misinformation or what have you. So to me, these sites are as different from Pruneyard as is a newspaper. And now the question is, what do we make of Turner? Because I agree that that is ultimately the only relevant case. And when I say that, what I mean is common carriage traditionally, as I said earlier, under the common law, common carriage is all about the nature of your offering to the consumer. If you hold yourself out as serving everyone indifferently, you are a common carrier. And as the court said in Midwest Video, in that sense, you don't compel someone to be a common carrier. You just recognize the nature of their offering. What's different about Turner is that it is essentially an effort to impose a kind of common carriage mandate, a must carry in that sense, upon a provider for some other reason. And in that case, the reason was the concern that provider had gatekeeper control. So let's note first that what the court meant there by gatekeeper control wasn't monopoly power. The court in Miami Herald had dealt with arguments about monopoly power and arguments, I think, that are much, much stronger than arguments about social media today. It wasn't that Facebook and Twitter are really big and they're problematic. It was that many markets in America in the 1970s, even as is true today, had only one newspaper. And also that newspaper maybe controlled the radio station. And those were the only media outlets. So that was it. So they literally had control over all the content that you could get. And yet the court said that didn't change the First Amendment analysis, that newspapers, regardless of their market power, had the same First Amendment rights. So what's different about Turner is that in 1994, the court says that the cable operator has gatekeeper control that is fundamentally different because there was only one wire that went into the home that was capable of carrying a multi-channel video programming service. This was before satellite television existed. So that was it. You either subscribed to cable or you just relied on over-the-air broadcasting to get a few channels. And in that sense, the court said, yes, that gatekeeper power is sufficient to justify the imposition of must carry, to say that you must carry broadcaster signals. But of course, the court only got there because it was applying intermediate scrutiny. If it had applied strict scrutiny, that clearly wouldn't have been a sufficiently compelling argument. And one of the reasons that the court applied intermediate rather than strict scrutiny is that no one in that case argued that the cable providers were objecting based on content. The intrusion upon editorial discretion in that case was simply that the cable providers were being denied the ability to configure the programming package in the most profitable way, because they could carry only so many channels. And for each broadcast station they had the channel to carry, they couldn't carry, say, the Golf Network or whatever. And so that's what that case was about. They didn't object based on any of the content of speech, because what they were being asked to carry was broadcast speech. So it was already policed by the FCC for indecency, heavily sanitized for other market reasons, et cetera. The situation today with social media is fundamentally different from both of those things. Whatever one may say about social media sites, they have market power, just like newspapers may have had market power. They don't have gatekeeper control. They're not the only way you get programming into your home. And then second, the debate about editorial discretion isn't just a debate about configuring programming packages and what's most profitable and so on. That is a, if you will, a less important form of editorial discretion than what we are talking about here, which is that social media sites don't want to carry what they consider to be hate speech, misinformation, efforts to suborn an election, whatever. And they want the editorial discretion. They want to exercise their First Amendment right to decide where to draw the line about those things. And the idea that they should be compelled to carry speech that they find reprehensible just because of market power or because of whatever, I think misapplies Turner. And I will just conclude with this, which is, Eugene knows more about the First Amendment than I do, and I will never I'll never dispute him on cases. But I will question his characterization of Twitter into breaking down neatly into two columns. Because Twitter, and I say this as somebody who spent the last 13 years on Twitter, Twitter is an interactive experience. And when you go to Eugene's to the Vault Conspiracy page, you're not just seeing the links and the posts that Eugene puts up. You're seeing all the other content that's posted in replies and the back and forth. And that interactive conversation is not very different from the conversation that we're having here today. And I would say that you, the Federalist Society, have the same First Amendment right to decide which two people got to participate in that conversation that Twitter has to decide who gets to participate in the conversation and which things can't be said, just as you could bleep out certain words that we say, or you could edit down this recording before you post it online.
Now, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to respond to that, and then we'll have plenty of time, or at least we'll have some time, I think, for Q&A, and I'll be happy to answer your question. But I just wanted to speak a little bit to this, because I think that if not quite everything, but almost everything that Barron said about Twitter as a speaking entity, Twitter as a place for speech, is also true of universities, right? Universities also speak. In fact, that's what universities predominantly do. Universities are also not monopolies, much less so they are even in their own niche, generally speaking, than Twitter or Facebook, but certainly they're not monopolies. They're certainly not monopolies from a perspective of employment interviews, so lots of other ways that military can recruit people. So Rumsfeld had to deal with this kind of situation. It also had to deal with the reality that many people really seriously objected to the presence of military recruiters. The universities did, many of their stakeholders did. Of course, not shareholders, because they don't have shareholders, generally speaking, but donors, right? So one question is, would Rumsfeld have come out differently if the university said, look, we have donors who are really upset at this. They think that by allowing recruiters, even under government compulsion, we would be endorsing an anti-gay agenda. They're threatening to withdraw their donations. We have evidence of calls in which we were telling them about how gay friendly we are and how hostile we are to anything that's not gay friendly. I don't think the court would have said, oh, well, in that case, of course, the universities are perfectly free to exclude the recruiters. In fact, the court went through this in considerable detail. It said, look, the schools say that they could be viewed as sending the message that they're fine with the military's policies if they allow it. But we rejected that similar argument in Premier because there was little likelihood, not no likelihood, but little likelihood that the views of those engaging in the expressive activities would be identified with the owner, in part because the owner is free to dissociate himself from those views, could put up little signs or whatever else, wasn't being compelled to affirm a belief in any governmentally prescribed position or view. And as we see later on in the last paragraph, because people appreciate the difference between the speech that a school sponsors and speech the school permits because legally required to do so. That if indeed some donor calls up and says, I'm withdrawing my donation, I'm not giving you any more money, I'm not paying for a wing, I'm not letting you name your school after me, or you can name it, but I'm not going to pay for it, because I'm so upset with you allowing recruiters. The school would be entitled to say, at least under this hypothetical, which the court was discussing, of the school being actually legally mandated allow the recruiters. The school would be entitled to say, look, we're not sponsoring it. We're only allowing it because we're legally required to do so pursuant to an equal access policy. Surely, although maybe they put it more politely, you haven't lost the ability to appreciate that difference. And presumably, indeed, most donors would say, well, all right, you know, it's not your fault that you have to allow these recruiters. So that's fine. I'll give you the donation. And if they say, nope, I refuse to donate any money to you because recruiters are allowed, well, that's kind of too bad. That's not a reason it's not a First Amendment argument that the school can give for refusing to allow these to allow recruiters onto its property. So the school is very much a speaker, even more, or perhaps let's say as much as Twitter is a speaker. And the school is also providing a platform on which others can speak. And the government, the court said unanimously in Rumsfeld, is entitled to institute an equal access policy, even a weird equal access policy there, which gave a special provision for government speakers. But the same would be true applying Pruneyard to a broader equal access policy, notwithstanding the fact that some people may dislike those speakers, as again, people certainly did in Rumsfeld, because you could explain to the public that you're only allowing them because you're legally required to do so. I think this logic applies every bit as much to Twitter. I'm sorry, Barry, if you want last word, that's great, but I also want to make sure we have time.
Yeah, if I may have one last word with screen sharing, if you could turn off yours, I'll just share one.
Sure, absolutely.
Rumsfeld.
You can screen shares.
We can't duel. So to me, the key line here that we haven't discussed is this. Accommodating the military's message does not affect the law school's speech because the schools are not speaking when they host interviews and recruiting receptions. In other words, everything you say is true. The schools have lots of expressive functions, but the court said recruitment is not one of those expressive functions. And my point, in a nutshell, is that telling social media sites what they can and cannot host is essentially like telling university what it may or may not do in its expressive functions. So for example, employment discrimination laws can be enforced online, right? That's more like recruitment. That's about the conduct, about how non-discrimination works in recruitment on LinkedIn or on Facebook or whatever. But when I read this paragraph, that seems to me to be exactly different from what we're discussing here today. And then second, on the question of disassociation, the court went out of its way again and again to say What was important there and what was important in Pruneyard was the ability to disassociate yourself from other speech. And my view is that that's actually, if anything, it's more difficult online. Not only because the expectation is that these services are responsible for content, contrary to, for example, cable systems. The court noted in Turner that cable systems had long carried speech, and users didn't think that that the service was responsible for it, just as we don't think that getting an obscene phone call is the responsibility of the telephone network. I think the user expectations clearly cut differently in the case of social media. But on top of that, it's actually very difficult to do this disassociation given the constraints of the online medium. And we just, for example, we can look at how Twitter struggled to deal with President Trump's tweets. They, long before they banned him in May of last year, they started posting labels. And those labels were spectacularly unsuccessful because they were unclear. They were difficult for users to understand. When the president posted misinformation about mail-in ballots, for example, the label that was applied to that just below that said, click here for more information about mail-in ballots. Unclear what that meant. Did that mean the president was onto something? Was it a rejection? And every time that Twitter tried to do something more, they found themselves criticized not only for not doing enough, but also for the inherent ambiguity of what they were posting. And what they ultimately decided was they couldn't disassociate themselves other than by either hiding his tweets or ultimately by removing him entirely from their service. So to me, the services themselves have tried. They have already said that disassociation is not possible and that they are judged ultimately by what they do, by market forces, and they're held responsible for that in exercising their editorial discretion. So I'll just stop there. I think we've probably beaten that horse to death. I know we have some questions from the audience.
Yeah, so I'm happy to let Baron have the last word on that. So some of the questions I think we could respond to without much disagreement. So for example, if a platform makes a defamatory statement in conjunction with restricting content, for example, Facebook blocks a user's content and says it did so because it contains hacked materials. This is a reference to an existing case. I don't want to speak to the facts of that case because haven't followed closely enough those facts. But as a general matter, I think we'd agree that under Section 230, if a platform says, let's take an extreme example. We deleted Volok's account because Volok hacked into our computers and it's false. Well, that's its own libel. They're going to be liable for this libel because they made a statement. It's not a third party statement. It's their own statement. And they're going to be liable for it under the standard rules of defamation law. Now, if they were to say, we deleted Volok's account because he's an idiot, well, that's not liable because it's opinion. Likewise, if they were to say, we've deleted his account because of this post, and we say this post is racist, that would also be opinion, because that would be an opinion based on undisclosed fact, but here it is, and here we're labeling it as such. So I think it's pretty clear that they would be liable. It's just a pretty rare thing, and I don't know of any cases in which that happened. Barry, do you disagree with that?
All I would add to that, that's absolutely correct, but the reason they're liable under Section 230 is because Section 230 builds in this analysis. This is a very subtle point that almost everyone misses. Right. Section 230(c)(1) only protects you if you are the provider or user of an interactive computer service, and it protects you from being held liable for information created by another information content provider. But if you look at the definitions, if you are responsible, even in part, this is in F, it's not up on the screen here, but yes, this right. term that he's highlighted, information content provider, is defined in one of the other subsections, to say that if you are responsible even in part for creating content, you become the information content provider. So C1 would not protect you from anything that you yourself create or even are partly responsible for creating. So that's actually a very easy question under Section 230.
So there's a question to me from Mark Boyle. As a classical liberal, do you agree with all of the Supreme Court cases you cited? As you no doubt know, the Pruneyard is highly critiqued by classical liberal. Well, I'm not a classical liberal in the sense of a libertarian. I'm like most people, kind of a hodgepodge, right? I have libertarian sympathies, and especially when it comes to policy matters, I have a very strong presumption of liberty, to borrow a line from Randy Barnett. But it's a presumption, it's a rebuttable presumption. And on top of that, it's not my view of the Constitution. The Constitution does not enact libertarian ideals. It's the free speech, it does enact, it does protect the freedom of speech. But it's certainly possible that some restrictions, even the ones the libertarians would disapprove of, would be constitutional, even when it comes to speech restrictions or speech compulsions. And that's especially so when the main foundation for the objection, as I understand the libertarian objection to Pruneyard, is a property rights objection, that they're private property owners and they shouldn't be required to do anything, to host anything, whether it's speech or anything else. And I appreciate the force of that argument. I just don't think the Constitution compels that. Now, as to what is the proper way of interpreting the First Amendment as a matter of first principles, hard for me to tell. It's not usually the way that I think or write. I talk about the precedents, generally speaking, because I'm more a lawyer than a philosopher. So as a legal matter, I think that certain kinds of common carrier mandates are constitutionally permissible. Now, that still leaves the question, of course, of whether there are good ideas a policy matter. And there I'm much more uncertain. I think that there are plausible arguments for requiring this kind of common carriage type approach, whether for cable companies or for phone systems or for UPS and FedEx. And there are plausible arguments against it. That's an interesting question. But I do want to resist the notion that we should be interpreting the First Amendment as classical liberals. Even if we are, it doesn't follow that the law, the constitutional law, imposes all of the libertarian restraints on legislatures that we think political morality ought to impose.
Well, if I may, I've spent the last 13 years of my life, instead of practicing law and making a lot more money, I've spent them trying to defend the ideas of liberty as applied to media and telecom and tech policy. And I do find Pruneyard to be deeply offensive. I find it to be emblematic of the radical left's approach, best typified by Jerome Barron's 1967 article, which developed a media access theory. It was essentially the idea that the First Amendment should be a sword for the government to use to fight whatever it doesn't like about speech, rather than a shield against government meddling. And I'm not alone in this view, or at least I didn't used to be. The conservative movement, free market people, spent decades fighting government meddling in media, primarily the Fairness Doctrine. And the Fairness Doctrine is denounced in the current Republican platform, recycled from 2016. This is the mainstream view, or at least it used to be, among Federalist Society types. And all that's changed now is that a certain number of Republican politicians have decided that to try to build their own version of the Fairness Doctrine, or something actually even more radical than it. And they're now citing cases like Pruneyard. But to Eugene's point about the law and the way that the court has applied it, I will only say that the court has not extended Pruneyard beyond that kind of case. It's never been applied to an entity that even colorably counts as a media entity. And I think the only case that we have a hard time applying here and deciding how to reconcile here is Turner. And I've already explained why I think Turner is fundamentally different here. I don't see an example in any case where the ideas of common carriage or other things have been held to compel a site that is in the business, sorry, a platform that is in the business of curating to not to host content that it doesn't want to host.
So if I can go through a couple of more of the questions. First of all, I should mention the first question, the one about platforms making their own defamatory statements. I should have mentioned it's from Sheila Oretsky. There's a question from Kevin McCarthy. By what authority has the U.S. government expended federal funds to provide the internet without imposing requirements of the common law of common carriage, which Constitution imposes on carriers who enjoy such a preemptive public right of way? Well, I know of no law that says the Constitution imposes such a requirement on government-funded programs. The authority for the U.S. government providing the original funding for the internet, for internet research, was probably the authority, essentially the complex of authority having to do with military preparedness. It was originally a Defense Advanced Research Project agency, a plan to try to deal with military preparedness, create a resilient system. To the extent it's provided more funding, there's also the general funding, more than just for military purposes, general right to spend for the general welfare. And I know of no cases that say once the government spends money on something, it has to provide common carrier rules for it. Certainly, that's not a First Amendment rule. There's a case called Rendell Baker versus Cone from 1982, which said that even a school, that case was over 90% funded. It was a private school, I think it was a school for children with learning disabilities, it was funded overwhelmingly by a state, but the court said that didn't make it a state actor. That didn't require it to abide by the First Amendment. Certainly wouldn't make it a common carrier. So I think that is very much a matter of government discretion. Now, maybe not even. Maybe the government can't impose common carrier rules on even on things that it funds. It's an interesting question. But at the very least, it doesn't have to. It could say the best way of dealing with certain things that we support is by providing common carrier system, like with roads and railroads and such, or alternatively, not doing that. So, for example, the government provides GI Bill funds and other kinds of funding for universities, for students who want to take those funds to universities. That doesn't make those universities state actors under the First Amendment or impose on the government some obligation to make them common carriers. Another question that comes up is whether subsection C2A, excuse me, this is from David Axelman. Subsection C2A seems to impose a good faith requirement in content moderation decisions. So what about a school room for a state regulating bad faith content moderation, e.g. when a platform clearly employs a double standard? So I think if you look at the statutory text, and again, it's the current statutory text, you can ask whether the statute should be changed. Look how broad it is in its authorization for the platforms. They can restrict access to material they consider to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable. So there's nothing in bad faith if a Twitter says, for example, we believe that certain anti-trans messages are objectionable. We consider them to be objectionable and we're going to ban them. For example, when somebody uses what we believe is the wrong pronoun, to refer to someone, or uses their pre-sex change name. Whereas pro-trans messages, we, in good faith, believe to be unobjectionable. I think that seems to me, under the statute, to be fully protected under the text. Again, maybe Congress got it wrong on that, but that's what considers to be objectionable means. Now, I do think and there's a case on this from the Ninth Circuit, that good faith requirement might deal with situations where something is a subterfuge for essentially anti-competitive conduct. When you block something, not because you find it objectionable based on its content, but because it's from a competitor and you're trying to drive the competitor out of business. Maybe, because it's true, good faith should mean something. But good faith can't mean a viewpoint neutrality requirement because considers to be otherwise objectionable, just like considers to be excessively violent or filthy, you know, that's something that's very much in the discretion by congressional design in the discretion of the platform, and as to otherwise objectionable, extremely broad discretion.
Well, indeed, I would say that both C1 and C2A are written to protect the full range of First Amendment protected editorial discretion, which does not include, for example, anti-competitive conduct. That wouldn't be covered by either C1 or C2A, just the same way as Eugene has explained that under Lorraine Journal, 1951, a newspaper can be sued under the antitrust laws for not carrying the advertisements of local advertisers who refuse to join in a boycott of the new radio station because the radio station is going to compete with the newspaper. Those are not protected against by the First Amendment, nor by Section 230. Alex, in the interest of time, since I know we're about to wrap up here, I just wanted to mention, we haven't talked about it yet, but Florida does have a law that is moving rapidly through the legislature that that would purport to create a private right of action and state enforcement to deal with many of these things. We don't have time to fully address this today, but I did put a link in the chat to the piece that my colleague Corbin Barthold and I wrote about this in Lawfare. And in a nutshell, I will just say that just as you cannot use consumer protection law to attempt to compel services to host content that they don't want to host, I don't think that analogies to campaign finance law are compelling either. And that's relevant because while that law is not overtly a campaign finance law, it has a number of provisions that would be relevant specifically for political candidates. And in particular, would seem to require, for instance, that if a social media site kicks off one candidate, they have to kick off the candidate's opponents. And to me, as we explain in that Lawfare piece, that is essentially a reboot of the Miami Herald case. The court has said repeatedly that digital media have the same First Amendment rights as other media. As Justice Scalia said in the Brown versus EMA case in 2010, the principles of the First Amendment do not vary when new technologies arise. And with the outlier here being Turner for its specific facts and broadcasting, because broadcasters themselves are licensed by the government, and therefore that is state action that allowed the government to impose the fairness doctrine and other requirements. With the exception of those two things, the court has made very clear that digital media have exactly the same First Amendment rights, and we should expect that Miami Herald will carry the day again, no matter what arguments are being made.
Excellent. Well, we are at the hour mark, and I want to thank Baron and Eugene. Thank you both again for joining us today. This was really informative. I enjoyed it a lot. And at that, we will conclude the session. Thank you again so much. And everyone, have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks, you too. Baron, great pleasure. All the best.
Likewise.